This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you for the next hour to discuss what's going on in the world of health. And we are rapidly closing in on Christmas, when people will be getting together, and we're going to go over today some of the things you can do to stay healthy in crowded environments and in poor weather. Now, we've been very fortunate to have some extremely nice weather, but we know that's going to change. So we want to be ready for that. We're going to have a guest in the second half of today's program. It's going to be Dr. Corey Dwyer. Dr. Dwyer is an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at UConn Health, and he specializes in orthopedic sports medicine. He trained at UConn and then at Stanford University. So he's going to talk to us a little bit about his experiences, especially when dealing with shoulder injuries and shoulder replacements. And it's always great to have a young physician on who's just starting their practice, just starting their career, especially here in Connecticut, where we so badly need physicians and in different fields to really support our population. And then, as a special surprise, we're going to have a taped message that I was able to get from Haiti from our friend Father Rick Frechette. Father Frechette is also a doctor. He's a medical doctor and became an osteopath. And he's been living in Haiti since 1987. Many of you who are regular listeners to the show will remember that he would often send a message back with me with my trips to Haiti, especially around Christmas time. Unfortunately, I've not been able to get back to Haiti, and many people have not because of the distress there. So we hear very little about it here, and that's why I wanted to have Father Rick send us a message, and he did that. So we're going to play that towards the bottom half of the hour today. This day in medicine, December 16, 1858, Dr. Richard Bright died. Now, Dr. Bright was the namesake of Bright's disease, which is a kind of a general term for nephritis or inflammation of the kidney. And there are forms that are both acute and chronic. And he first described inflammation of the kidneys or nephritis or glomerulonephritis back in 1827. And the signs of that in general are protein in the urine. People will develop a lot of edema and swelling, retention of fluids, hypertension, cardiac disease all go with that. And we break it up into acute and chronic. Acute meaning it's come on in a few weeks, whereas chronic is where it's developed slowly, almost an evolution from the acute to the chronic stage. When we think of acute nephritis or acute inflammation of the kidneys, we think of infections. We think of autoimmune problems like lupus or something called Goodpasture syndrome, where it's an autoimmune response against the kidneys and the lungs. And then, as always, we have the chronic form of nephritis that you often see associated with cancer or autoimmune problems, again, or exposure to hydrocarbons. You diagnose it based on several different things. One is imaging, things like ultrasound or a CT scan. You could do a biopsy of the kidneys. But before you even get there, and something that tips you off is obviously a urinalysis, looking at the urine, the contents of the urine, and doing blood tests. The treatments are basically to treat whatever is causing the problem. So if it's an infection, treat the infection. If it's an autoimmune problem, most likely you're going to use immunosuppressant medications, including corticosteroids. When it becomes chronic and severe, the treatment is dialysis, so renal dialysis, and hopefully in some cases going on to transplantation. So we remember Dr. Bright, who passed away this day in 1858. I'm always astounded at, when this was described in 1827, and, we still are dealing with it and how the treatments have evolved. I mean, as recently as the 1950s, we didn't have dialysis, and people died. I had a family member, a great aunt of mine, who died from lupus and kidney disease from that. And that autoimmune disease. We're in this stage now where we're going to be close to each other this winter. And we have to deal with hospitalizations related to infection. So I like to give everybody an update with whatever reliable data we have. Right now, nationally, COVID hospitalizations are up by 51%. So it's rising in anticipation of the holidays. We have the flu is up by 200%. This is hospitalizations, not just people who have the flu. And RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, is up 60%. So clearly we're seeing this wave, this rise of these infections, many of which, all of these three at least, we are able to suppressed to some extent. Now, I want to make that clear that it's a suppression. If you get a vaccine, it doesn't mean you're not going to get the problem, but it does mean there's a good chance you're not going to the hospital for it or being admitted to the hospital. So also, we see a lot of these bigger numbers are in the South right now. And again, it's like a wave that starts coming north. So it should be hitting us in the next couple of weeks, right around the holidays, when everybody wants to get together. No one wants to miss an event to be with their family. No one wants to wear a mask. So we're going to be faced with a problem. How do we get around that? We have vaccines. Vaccines are the single greatest development in medical science ever in the history of medicine. No question about it. When you look at the data of the number of lives saved with vaccines, there's nothing in comparison. Yet, only 40% of children and adults have received the COVID vaccine. And only 17% of adults have gotten the updated vaccine. Again, this is a vaccine to keep you out of the hospital. It's a vaccine that's free of charge and readily available at any pharmacy. And again, I've gotten all of them. I always say that, if you have a question about it, the question for your doctor is, well, what would you do or what did you do in this situation? Did you get the vaccine? Did you recommend that your family got the vaccine? So I can tell you that I got the vaccine and my family got the vaccine. And those of us over the age of 60 got the RSV vaccine. You know, we fight this thing because we have these medical freedom crusaders now. And these are people who want the right to not get vaccinations. And you see them more in certain states. And that's where we're starting to see the measles outbreak start. And we're going to see it more and more. Let's not forget, measles killed 500 people a year in the past. We wiped it out with the vaccine. And now we have people starting up again. And I don't need to bore you with all of this, but to be honest with you, it's gotten crazy. I mean, we had polio. 15,000 people at best. I think that's a conservative number of people paralyzed from polio. Again, we wiped it out with a vaccine. You know, whenever science and politics get confused, that's a recipe for disaster. And this whole thing about religious, there's no major religion that objects to vaccines. And it always raises the question is, if someone acts irresponsibly, are the rest of us who did follow the rules and did the best thing to stay healthy, should we be responsible for their medical costs? So if someone gets polio and now becomes incapacitated to some degree, so they're going to have needs, and those needs rely on the rest of society to support them. Now, I'm not saying we just leave people on the side, but is there not some obligation to the rest of your community to do the right thing, to get vaccinated if you're eligible for it, or to try and quit smoking, or to wear a helmet when you're riding a motorcycle? Again, topics for discussion and something for us to all think about. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back. We're going to chat a little bit more, and then as a special surprise, we're going to have a taped message that I have from my friend, Father Rick Frechette. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
The holly green, the ivy green, the prettiest picture you've ever seen.
It's Christmas in Killarney with all of the folks.
We're back
at
on
home.
Healthy Rounds. It's I'm nice your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. If you have any thoughts or questions during the show or during the week, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. I want to get back to things we could do to stay a little more healthy and safer over the holidays. And as I mentioned, the weather's been mild lately, but we know it's going to change. And I think that there are several things that we need to keep in mind, especially for those of us who are older, to try and stay healthy and stay out of the hospital. The first of those is shoveling snow. Okay. Just don't do it if you don't have to. And don't do it if you're not accustomed to heavy-duty cardiac activity, workouts and things like that. Because this sudden change, right, will promote a heart attack. And I can't tell you how often that has happened. It was almost like every major snowstorm, you would see people coming into the emergency room with heart attacks and strokes. So shoveling snow, just put it off. Hire somebody. Car accidents. You know, when the roads are icy like this, you really have to take into consideration that you may not be able to stop, okay, in a short period of time. And more importantly, if you don't have to drive, just don't. You know, there are a lot of, one of the things that's come out of COVID is we got a lot of delivery services, okay? If you need something, order it. They'll deliver it. The usual slips and falls. You know, I work in the Department of Orthopedics, and we're about to have Dr. Dwyer on. These slips and falls on icy paths typically result in fractures, broken hips, broken arms. Make sure you have proper footwear on. Even if you're just going out to bring in the garbage or get the mail, make sure you have proper footwear on. A lot of people are out there putting their decorations up, taking the decorations down. Ladders are dangerous. They're dangerous if you're not used to climbing a ladder, and especially if you're older, right? We lose a lot of our ability to keep our balance. And as always, you don't want to move the ladder, so I'm going to stretch over, and that's when they go down. And so ladders are just a dangerous thing as you become older, and especially in winter. And one of the things we don't think about are falling icicles. Sometimes you see these huge icicles forming on the side of your house, on the side of a gutter, on a bridge. Don't stand under them. They could break at any point and result in severe head injury. One of the other ones I'm particularly concerned about is carbon monoxide poisoning. You see that from fireplaces, wood stoves, gas stoves. They sell these little portable carbon monoxide detectors. You can get it on Amazon for $40. If you're going away somewhere, take it with you. If you're renting a house, you're doing an Airbnb, you just plug it into the wall, okay? It could save your life and the life of your family. So please keep these things in mind. Next up, we're going to hear from Father Rick Frechette. Father Frechette is a Catholic priest. He is a physician, and he has dedicated his life to the poor of Haiti. He has opened two hospitals, the St. Damien Hospital and the St. Luke Hospital, all in the Tabar section of Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Father Rick is especially attached to us here in Connecticut. He's from West Hartford, where he was born and raised. And he continues, despite the violence going on there, there's basic gang rule. The police have not been able to control these gangs. The army has not been able to control these gangs, and they run freely with weapons. And I wanted to hear directly from him. So with that, Kevin's going to roll that interview, and then I'll be back to wrap that up.
Dear Tony, I thank you for inviting me onto your radio station. This is Father Rick Frechette. I'm in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. I know that news of Haiti is rather rare, but you're certainly aware of how this country has fallen into levels of chaos and violence that are totally unbelievable and shocking. And it's not easy, I think, in many places of the world to give a positive Christmas message, except to reinforce the fact that we believe in the dignity of human beings created by God, and that we commit ourselves around the world to work for better situations for all people, uplifting, upward moving, full of life, and aim towards life always. This is our hope, this is our posture, this is our attitude before all these terrible problems. Everybody and every institution, those who haven't fallen yet, of both, are tremendously stressed, and we're no exception. And we're all fighting to continue our services in circumstances that just eat away at everything organized and structured, even from the entry of materials through corrupt ports and closed borders with the Dominican Republic, and just starting from there and going in every direction. But in any case, we're continuing our greatly reduced hospitals. We're continuing in our schools, which are also somewhat reduced. We're watching the flight of our staff to the United States, to Canada, to Europe, and feeling the pinch of the loss of capacity and talent and goodness of the people that are going, totally understandably. But we're committed and convinced to preserve our institutions and the part of civilization, Christian civilization, that our institutions are contributing here in Haiti. We spend an awful lot of time, an awful lot of time, an awful lot of time on rescuing vulnerable people, vulnerable orphanages, vulnerable schools, vulnerable communities who are cut off from water and food, trying to work out freedom for people that are kidnapped and held in hostage. It's a lot of time, especially my own time, goes into this very ugly dimension of having to deal with very bad people to try to get very good things done. But in any case, we're inspired by the heroism of the Haitian people, especially the ordinary peasant with no ability to fly anywhere or run anywhere, no extra money in bank accounts to help them see through tough times. But we're so inspired by the example of all Haitian people, but especially so the poorest, for their determination to care for their families, run to safety on behalf of their children, do anything that's needed to find something to eat for their families. It's so motivating to see it, and they're so deserving, so very deserving of the help of the human family. So to all of you, we wish you a Merry Christmas, every blessing in the new years. In spite of our difficulties, we live a lot of blessings. And part of our blessings are you and your own commitment here, Tony. And certainly part of our blessings are the contributions that your listeners can send to help us or any other organization working here in Haiti to continue with their noble work. So thank you very much for being concerned, and God bless you. Merry Christmas.
Sobering words from Father Rick Frechette. If you are so inclined to make a donation, you can go to stlukehaiti.org. Even if you cannot make a donation, go to the site, become familiar with the charity. And I think even just saying a prayer and remembering him and the work being done there for these people who are so oppressed and threatened in Haiti. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Corey Dwyer, and we're going to be talking about orthopedic surgery and sports. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Santa Claus is coming to town.
We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And if you want to reach us while we're on the air, we're at info@alessimd.com. My guest today is Dr. Corey Dwyer. Dr. Dwyer is an assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at UConn Health. He's also an orthopedic surgeon specializing in sports injuries. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Alessi. Appreciate it.
So, hey, listen, let's talk a little bit. Why don't you give the listeners a little idea of your background and education overall?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a through and through Connecticut guy. I've done pretty much all my training at UConn, whether I did my undergrad at Storrs, graduated in 2012, and then I was lucky enough to meet a few faculty at the UConn School of Medicine during that time, and did my med school training at Farmington, and it kind of trickled down from there. I did my residency at UConn in orthopedic surgery, had awesome mentors, and then last year I actually completed a fellowship in sports medicine at Stanford University in California on the West Coast. So I'm happy to be back home, though, that's for sure.
Corey, one of the things I noticed in your resume was you went and got an MBA somewhere along the way. What made you decide to get that?
Yeah, so, well, at UConn Med, you're actually lucky enough to potentially do a combined program. So during the experiences on my clinical rotations in my third year, you know, I kind of noticed that there's a little less autonomy that physicians have nowadays. And, you know, for us to really have a seat at the table, it's important to learn the language and learn those important concepts. So I was able to take a year off to work on an MBA, and then I was able to graduate with a combined MD-MBA following that. So it was a neat experience, got to meet a different set of people, and, you know, it's something I value it to this day.
Well, I'm sure it's going to come in handy. But
yeah,
what was your attraction to orthopedic surgery and specifically orthopedic sports?
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up, my mother was a physical therapist and my father was a teacher and coach. And I think those kind of drew me a little bit more into orthopedics. But, you know, I was the youngest of three brothers, and God bless my parents. We played sports every weekend and they were shuttling us around. So you know, I wouldn't even say I was a has-been. I was rather never was when it comes to sports. But I always had the admiration for an athlete who's willing to work hard, push their body to the limit. And so I think those kind of go hand in hand. You know, huge UConn sports fan growing up, or a Boston-based team, no offense to your Yankees, but, you know, I always kind of want to be part of that mix. So, but it's an honor to get to take care of them today.
What's the most common thing you see? So you're in clinic and you're in the operating room. What are some common things that you see in your clinic specifically?
Sure, yeah. Well, I am a sports surgeon, number one, but I do have more of a focus in shoulder. So I get a wide variety of conditions. I think you consider younger folks may have more so instability. Older folks may have arthritis, but I think that's very common is rotator cuff injuries. And there's a wide variety of injuries. You know, it's rather commonplace. We hear of it a lot. However, every patient has a different type of injury, whether it's a different tear pattern or their tissue's different or how long they've been dealing with it is different. So that's probably one of the most common things I see. And it's something that we're still trying to figure out, the perfect treatment algorithm. So it's an exciting challenge, but you know, I think it's important to kind of be aware that, you know, we can work together to do rehab or do injections, or even if it requires surgery. That's probably the most common thing I see at this point.
Corey, how do you know when to operate and when not to operate on a rotator cuff? I mean, because there are so many things that can go wrong in
right.
a rotator cuff, right? You know, it. You know, how do you use which option? You know, physical therapy, surgery, or now, I mean, let's face it, people are out there touting regenerative medicine, right?
Yeah.
So how does that all fit together with somebody with a torn rotator cuff, partially torn rotator cuff, labral tear? How do you look at that?
Yeah. You know, it's a tricky situation because we're still trying to find, you know, the perfect pathway, but every patient's different. So we have to consider several things, whether it's your age, comorbidities. There are a few things there that we take into account, but also looking at the tear pattern on an MRI, sometimes we don't know of it till the day we put the actual scope in if we need to do that. However, you know, one thing I harp on with patients is that it's a surgery that takes me a couple hours, but it's at least a 6-month recovery. So I think it's very important that, you know that going into it. But if we can manage things conservatively at first with physical therapy, maybe the addition of injections. So there are those a few certain cases where we would want to operate early rather than later. But at least I try to let patients know I'm in it with you before surgery and especially after, but we can try to get you better without a surgery too.
What about regenerative medicine? Does that play a role in this now, or is that, I mean, you see billboards, people are talking about it. Is there a role for that in treatment of the shoulder?
I guess if you're you know, kind of lumping in orthobiologics into that, I get a little bit cautious. I think at least here at UConn, we've done a good job investigating the effects of things you may hear of like PRP or stem cells. I think they have a narrow use. It's not something that has really been sorted out yet, so I'm cautious about using those, especially because some things are not covered by insurance. However, you know, I think really grilling the physician who may be utilizing that is important. I know we talk about certain adjuncts when we do surgery, such as a rotator cuff repair, to try to get a better environment for healing. In those cases, I'm more likely to use them, but I have other non-operative partners who are leading the frontier on that I pick their brain to see if this patient in particular would benefit from a regenerative type of injection or medication. So I'm cautious in the use of that.
You talked about the, approximately 6 months of recovery after shoulder mm-hmm. surgery. Patients have told me, who have had multiple orthopedic surgeries, that the most painful recovery has been the shoulder. Is there a reason for that? Is that pretty accurate?
Well, I think you got to consider the nature of the injury. I think, thankfully, we don't, you know, we've evolved to no longer walk on our shoulders. So at least, you know, we're not putting so much weight on them. However, folks are really reliant on putting the hand in space, and that's really the function of the shoulder. So things we take for granted, whether it's just getting dressed in the morning or feeding ourselves or trying to take care of other daily tasks, I think you'd notice it more. Now, yes, a rotator cuff surgery can – you can be in some solid pain after a surgery. So that's why I try to lay crepe with folks that it is a long recovery, but we're really trying to get the tendon to heal back down. But I would, you know, other shoulder surgeries are not as painful. I know I also do shoulder replacements, and those are some of the happiest patients because they've dealt with such chronic pain in their shoulder for so long. And then being able to take away that arthritis and get their shoulder gently moving appropriately, I know folks are very happy pretty soon after that surgery. So there's a wide variety, I'd say.
So let's take a look at that. The term arthroplasty, can you talk about that general term itself?
Yeah, so there are different types of arthroplasty. Essentially, what we're trying to do is take away the damaged parts of the shoulder and replace them with artificial components. The whole point of that is really to relieve pain and restore function for those that may have severe arthritis or other degenerative conditions. Someone who's had a long-standing rotator cuff tear can develop something we call arthropathy. There are other patients that have rheumatoid arthritis. So there's different flavors of shoulder replacement or shoulder arthroplasty. You'll hear total shoulder arthroplasty, where we replace the ball or the head of the humerus with a component, and then we also replace the socket, and it looks very similar to your regular anatomy. But there's something that you also may hear of called a reverse shoulder arthroplasty or reverse shoulder replacement, and that could be for patients who have had long-standing massive rotator cuff tears, where essentially we reverse that ball and socket configuration, and it allows other muscles to take over, such as the deltoid, the big muscle in the shoulder, so that you no longer have to rely on the rotator cuff tendons. So that's something that's a hot topic that we debate, of who should get a total shoulder versus a reverse total shoulder. But at the end of the day, we're really trying to relieve pain and restore function.
When you look at the different types of shoulder replacement, is there an issue of you don't want to do it in somebody too young? I mean, do you do repeats? In other words, if somebody then wears out the prosthesis, do you do it again? Or how does that work if you have to do a replacement in someone who's relatively young?
Yeah. So I would say young shoulder arthritis is a special interest of mine, because it's very tricky, right? It's do we try to do something minimally invasive first? Because once we try to remove bone or arthritis, there's not much to go back. We harp on, I try to get to know you more in terms of figuring out what are your expectations, what other issues you may have, because some folks may benefit from a regular anatomic total shoulder, meaning the ball replaces the ball. But we need to make sure that your rotator cuff is good. And I know of patients where the rotator cuff may tear and it's no longer a stable joint. So then we have to consider a reverse total shoulder. So there are some patients that will need revision surgery, but that's why I'm very cautious of who gets a total shoulder and who gets a reverse total shoulder.
I had a question come in here by email from Bob asking, how often can you get steroid injections into your shoulder? This is obviously someone who's been receiving them and wants to know how often could he or should he have those injections?
Yeah, I think it's important to space them out every few months. Every surgeon is a little bit different. We know that potentially with repeated injections, it can actually potentially damage the tendon. So that's why you're very judicious with it. Also, repeated injections aren't necessarily healthy for the cartilage. So shoulder injections also have different flavors and different techniques and what they're used for. So I'd space them out at least every 3 months, but every surgeon has a different limit. But it depends on the patient's overall situation. There are some folks who are too sick to go to surgery, and therefore may be best managed with multiple injections. But there are some patients who would benefit from surgery right away. So there's really no great magic number, but spacing them out is quite appropriate.
Are there other things other than steroids that you can inject into a shoulder to get relief? I know we talked about a little bit about biologics, but are there other things that can be used?
Yeah, I know. There's some newer literature stating that maybe we can use some specialized injections that are more anti-inflammatory without it being a cortisone injection. You'll hear of ketorolac or Toradol has been discussed. There are some other injections that are hyaluronic based. Those are a little more popular in the knee, to be totally frank with you, but they have been used in the shoulder as well.
Another question from Mary comes in. She sees a physical therapist who does dry needling for her shoulder pain. Can you talk a little bit about dry needling and what that does and what the purpose of it is?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the big things that we try to focus on is I wouldn't, you know, recommend doing dry needling standalone, but it's in order to help better control your pain, to promote blood flow, and to get you motivated to work with therapy. Now, there are numerous muscles that attach to the shoulder blade, so if things can allow you to optimize your work with a therapist and promote blood flow, that's always beneficial. So that'd be one of the reasons why it would be helpful to adjunct that with your therapy.
How common, how often are you doing shoulder replacements? I mean, they're relatively new from the standpoint of being effective. I know they've gone through a period. They're not, obviously, you know, we're all familiar with hip replacements for years and knee replacements. But can you go a little bit into the evolution of the shoulder replacement? Because it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so shoulder replacement's a little bit different compared to hip and knee replacements. If you were to really look at textbooks, the shoulder blade, there's not much bone there. So trying to get an implant dialed in perfectly is always a challenge. So that's been some of the struggles, if you look historically, with developing shoulder replacements, is to figure out ways to prevent complications. And so, you know, I think we're getting better and better about putting the implant in a perfect spot to limit those complications. So therefore, the prevalence has increased in regards to those that have shoulder replacements. And I would say really what's picking up is the reverse shoulder replacement. We're seeing that registries, whether it's Australia or in Europe, when they look at the survivorship of these shoulder replacements, they're lasting longer and longer. So I think surgeons are willing to put them in because they can hopefully be a one-and-done surgery for patients. So I think that's where you're seeing an increase. Also, there is some newer technology to help us position the shoulder implants in a better spot, whether that's preoperative software planning. It allows you to rehearse your surgery several times. You know, for me, it's kind of like planning for game day. If you make that sports relationship, is I get to practice and look and consider all these different little subtle techniques so that when we go into the day of surgery, it almost feels like game day. It's time to execute the plan. But I think, you know, more and more people will feel comfortable. Either surgeons will feel more comfortable performing the surgery, and patients can have a better understanding of what to expect after. So I think you'll see a continued rise, especially as we have an aging population that could benefit from the surgery. We need to continue to improve upon it. And I think, lastly, we're trying to come up with ways, you know, you'll hear in total hips and total knees that they're using a robot. There's really no great equivalent for that in the shoulder yet, but there are other technologies to essentially help us better position implants for a successful outcome.
We're chatting today with Dr. Corey Dwyer, who's an orthopedic surgeon and assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at UConn Health. Just so I get it in, if you wish to contact Dr. Dwyer, set up an appointment, you could do that by going to this number, 860-679-6600. Corey, what percentage of your surgeries do you think are open procedures versus scopes?
So I would say rather right now it's probably 75-25, 25% open, 75% arthroscopic procedures. I think if we consider shoulder arthroplasty as open, I think here at UConn, between myself and my other partners, more likely to do the open procedures because, I'll be honest, what we see are some more of the complex shoulders. So that's one thing that I've always sought in my training was to be comfortable doing surgery open. But it's a select indication that for those who need open. But yeah, about 75-25, I would say.
But getting back to sports, we have a lot of parents and grandparents who listen to the show. What advice do you have for them if they have children and grandchildren who are young athletes, especially in throwing sports? What advice can you give them?
I mean, my advice I'd give to parents of young athletes is just the reminder that balance is key. You know, there's always been a drive to specialize in one sport. We see that with the increase in AAU and other leagues. Now, I have to admit, I'm not a father yet, but I can imagine I would want to do anything for my child to succeed. But there's been research out there that the athletes who specialize in one sport are nearly twice as likely to suffer from an overuse injury compared to athletes that don't specialize in one. So it's really important to just mix things up, mix up the training, cross train. There are other skills that are going to translate. In regards to throwers, it's really important to take time off. We have better research now. You know, we don't have the exact magic number of how many months, but it's really important to take time, at least even in the off season, to just shut it down, shut down the throwing. Focus on the core to floor muscles, whether that's abs, the glutes, the quads, the hamstrings. Especially if you really want to set yourself up for success, we know that a lot of the power that comes from throwing comes from the lower body. Rather than trying to throw as hard as you can, it's the drive of the lower body. So focus on those things is really key. At the end of the day, I guess the reminder is that sports, you know, provide great lessons for life that we try to take away. You know, it's trying to work in a team, set goals, gain mental toughness, and at the end of the day, though, it's important to take care of your body because only few really make it to the pros. I think a stat that sticks with me is in 2016, they put out that only 0.1% of high school football players made it pro, and that career may not even be that long. So, you know, try to take away the valuable lessons that sports has to provide, but I guess the biggest takeaway is shut it down for a little bit and mix up the sports.
Corey, what's some future innovation you could share with us? Something we're going to be hearing about with respect to orthopedic surgery and orthopedic sports. Where do you think this field is going?
So I think, you know, we've already been embedded with the discussion of orthobiologics. As much as we love doing surgery, if we can optimize a patient beforehand, with those things that we talked about, whether it's a certain type of PRP injection, which takes your own blood and tries to tease out certain cells to inject back into a certain location. I think we're trying to tease out those nuances. Also, other anti-inflammatories to allow your own cells to promote healing rather than undergoing the knife. I think that's something that we're trying to do. And from a surgeon standpoint, as much as I love doing surgery, if we can continue to innovate that field, that makes life easier for us because those who really need it are undergoing surgery, but also we can use that to optimize healing. I think the big takeaways from an orthopedic surgeon is, you know, we try to get bone to heal the bone. We try to get tendon to heal the bone. And those who have a major ligament injury, we try to utilize a graft to act like that ligament. So try to promote that healing is quite important. We're not just carpenters, I would say.
All right. Well said. Corey, thank you. Thanks for your time today. And really, thanks for coming back to Connecticut. We need more young physicians to come back to our state. I'm just glad to have you back and glad to have you as a partner of mine at UConn Health. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. Matt Sorois helped me get that interview transposed for Father Frechette. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we're off, right, because we have the Christmas store going. So what we will be back on December 30th. If you missed any part of today's show, you can get it at Odyssey.com and just download the Healthy Rounds podcast to hear from Dr. Dwyer. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until, actually 2 weeks, so until we chat again, please stay healthy, and everyone have a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.